kupenda, unipe chungwa kupenda ngo, usiku tukiafanya mambo, cause you fine and too sweet. Ah, hey. Let's do this. Ah, hey. With two kids. Ah, hey. Ah, yeah, 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 yeah.
With Wonder, track 7 off of his EP entitled First of All. The video to that song was just released April 18th, and it already has over 4 million views. It's amazing. Hello, everybody. How y'all doing? I'm Heather Maxwell, and we are about to go old school for a minute with Sally Nyolo of Cameroon. But first this.
Watch Music Time in Africa on YouTube. Artist interviews, live performances, and awesome music videos. Get it all in one place on the Music Time in Africa YouTube channel.
All right, so we're going to listen to Sally Nyolo, her song called Shana. And let me tell you about it. It's from her first solo album called Tribu that was recorded in 1996. Now, all the tracks on that album were sung in her native tongue, Iton, and she wrote and composed all of them except for one. Now, in this song, she sings for her friend Celia. And here's what she says. At that particular hour when the twilight snails hang from the tip of trees' leaves, Cecilia sang as she gave birth. She gave birth to a shining little girl. She shines like the moon and the sun. The girl of Cecilia Kankunda sprung from love and from the mixture of races, the daughter of Nicholas and my friend Cecilia. Today, I sing and dance to honor her. Today, I celebrate Shana's birth. Shana, if you're listening today, you're still alive and well on this earth. I hope you enjoy this.
Shana walio, shana walio. Amuyu majema mongana mongo, aburu majema mongana mbomo, oktara majema mongana shana walio, shana walio.
shana itinga matongo ya poresi mongwana nikola mongwana chichili ya mboya mo amuyu majema mongwana mongo abora majema mongwana mbomo bokara majema mongwana shana waliyo shana waliyo amuyu majema mongwana mongo abora majema mongwana mbomo bokara majema mongwana shana waliyo shana waliyo
late Sally Nyolo with Shana. Hey guys, this is Heather, and now we're going right back to today's chart toppers. This time on TikTok with Samet Gaida. He brings us our second musical guest of the hour from Ghana.
Thank you, Heather. I present to you the first song from Northern Ghana trending on TikTok. Manjilala is a song by Young Shark from Tamale.
Let's start with introduction of who you are. Who is Young Shark?
Well, Young Shark is a versatile artist from the northern part of Ghana. And then my full name is Musa Abdul Shakur, but my stage name is Young Shark, Y-U-N-G-S-H-A-K, not the shark underwater, the shark on earth.
Yeah. So where are you from?
I'm from Tamale here.
You were born and bred in Tamale?
Yeah, I was born and bred in Tamale.
Since 1960, always she didn't give me zero of me.
Now, how would you describe your style of music?
My style of music is a unique style. It's a fusion of Afrobeat and several genres. So you can call it Afrofusion. That's my style of music, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about your latest hit,
Manjilala. Manjilala is my latest song that's trending all over. Manjilala basically is a song that I did out of people going through depression. The inspiration behind Manjilala is a woman who doesn't give a man the chance to feel loved, even though he gives her love back, you get me? She doesn't reciprocate his love, you get me? So with that, it makes the guy feel sad. But in his realm of sadness, it doesn't allow depression to drown him, you get me? So I played the song for people out there to be able to listen to the song, even irrespective of the circumstances they are facing in the realms or circles of love or anything. They can still be happy. They can still listen to it and jam and then dance to it and then sing out loud and be happy. Yeah. So in that sense, it will surely erase depression.
All right. So yes. Can you give us a freestyle?
A freestyle. Okay. Yeah, yeah, gayo yo. Chup chup chup. Buka gunagar kunkuni manjel lala. Chi manjel. Yeah, yeah, gayo yo. Buka gunagar kunkuni. Ay nang dumashamo. Dem solo mirka nang dumalala. Manjel lala. Manjel lala. Since 1960. Since 1960, always she dey give me 0 minutes. Bundelika in yoga kante, yoga kante. Oza konko gar agege, gar agege.
Yeah, that's it. Wow, that's lovely. Oza konko gar agege. Yeah. So, that's about it. But what are you working on currently?
Yeah, I'm working on my next project and. Hopefully it's going to be something bigger than Manjelala. Yeah.
From Tamale, Northern Ghana, I'm Samad Gaida. Over to you, Heather Maxwell.
All right, thank you, Samad and Young Shaq. Awesome. Hey, everybody, I hope you liked that special from Ghana. I sure did. But now we are going to Mauritania. This is Pulagu by Fama Mbai, who pays homage to the Pul or Fulani tribe.
Sadam ni people. This is your lady Sharifa Gunu, and you are listening to Hedda Maxwell. Music Time in Africa, VOA.
Yeah. All right. Hey, guys. This is Heather. Are you ready for more chart toppers now? This is Naogopa by Platinums. Number one song on Boomplay's Tanzania Top 100 and number 12 on Top 100 Africa.
Mapenzi sio makasiriko kwetu ni furaha tele maana mapenzi sio makasiriko hata kama tukishindia tembele oh my love baba mwenye nyumba kodi apige kelele. Mina we my love, eti chetu chumba kina mavyo motele inahusu. Oh, wala sidhani kama unipendi, ila nawaza usipokuwepo nitaishije.
Diamond Platinums. Hey, everybody, this is Heather Maxwell. Next up, more current music by Reem Fikri from Morocco with Awa, followed by Ma Vie a Changé by Togolese superstar Santrinos Raphael. Here, Reem sings, "Tell me why. Why is he the one that my heart desires? And why can't I heal from my broken heart? My patience is ending."
Oh, attention to the drum.
Diplômé pourtant, non, ça ne va pas. Des demandes d'emploi, j'en ai fait ici et là. On m'a dit qu'on m'appellera, mais on ne m'appelle pas. Et même quand j'entreprends, ça ne marche toujours pas. Mais non, ce n'est pas normal. Mon Dieu, tu es où, ma? S'il te plaît, fais quelque chose, une petite chose. Ma vie doit changer. Mais non, ce n'est pas normal. Mon Dieu, tu es où, ma? S'il te plaît, fais quelque chose, une petite chose. Ma vie doit changer. Continue d'essayer. Crois en toi, je vais percer. Crois en Dieu, il faut prier. Bientôt, il va t'exaucer. Continue d'essayer. En toi je vais percer. Quand Dieu il faut prier. Il ne faut jamais te décourager. Ame si ame Beti me di di ne vay mene. Epe ame a di di nge nge bema une wena me si ame. Ame si ame do la bota na e bakbe. Bota na e bakbe ne ji joe kunu koko bana nye.
So sweet. Hello, everybody. That was Santrinos Rafael with his 2022 single, Ma Vie a Changé. Before that, we had Reem from Morocco with Awa. So, guys, I have two more tunes for you before we have to say goodbye. This first one is brand new, out of Ghana, by Kirani Ayat. And the visuals dropped just this weekend. It's called Sarki.
Natashi, a quake could be but in the Kuba, Nashan Champagne, Kunashan, House of Bia, Nashan Rose, Kunashan, Soboro, Quiz Narita, the Astrofa Kutiatika at the food, Belgian, the Kuba sounding Gaya, Tashitumba Maku, Sulijin Yarun, the share, some instead from Ghana, Egan and Belgian, the Sunaji, the Sunni. These boys, they're faking it, Babu do Bakune. Your bands is borrowed, need a nova, yeah, but I see broke boys upset my tummy. Feed on goo bed, the Korea, the Matana, so now this is don't live next to me. Bako, what does I forget that I need? Cause these boys put me in the weed, shout out, send Lucy the Kato, Bungi, the Kara, and the Kayaran, Arabaku, Tashi, Nanga, but then I will never lie.
Sarki by Kirani Ayat from Ghana. And for the last song of the hour, here is Fireboy, DML, and Ed Sheeran's Peru. Now, this jam is so awesome. It's still on Billboard Hot 100 at number 54. Fireboy's real name, by the way, is Adedamola Adefolahan. I think I said that right. And he was born February 5th, 1996 in Ogun State, Nigeria. Wow. Peru,
pa, pa. Peru, Peru, pa. I'm blue. Even Peru done the para. Tonight in Josie.
not in a rush. I can hear music when you're here. Tonight we're rolling, party till closing. Since I put the ring on the finger, it's still frozen. Love in slow motion. I wanna feel you over me, yeah. Certain magic in your eyes, yeah. Girl, I love the way you ride it. And it happens every time you arrive. That's right. Girl, I want you in my life, yeah. There's a heaven in this right here. I will never leave your side. Stay tonight, tonight. When you won't see me, when you won't see me, I'm in West London this evening. Giving me the feelings, no, I'm not leaving.
All right, and with Fireboy DML and Ed Sheeran, it is time to say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining me today, and also a big thank you to Young Shock and Samet Gaida from Tamale, Ghana, and to Calligraph Jones and Bill Odidi from Nairobi, Kenya, for joining me in this episode. This program broadcasts live on shortwave and select local FM stations every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can also find it online at voanews.com. Just search for me, Heather Maxwell, or Music Time in Africa. Till next time, stay beautiful and stay safe.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Marissa Melton. Russia claims to have captured Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine after a nearly three-month siege that leaves over 20,000 civilians feared dead. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Russia's defense minister Sergei Shoigu declared what he called a complete liberation of Mariupol and of the Azovstal steel plant in the port city. The plant was the last stronghold of Ukrainian resistance. There was no immediate confirmation from Ukraine. Russian state media claimed over 2,400 Ukrainian fighters who had been holed up in the steel mill had surrendered. As they surrendered, the troops were taken prisoner by the Russians, and at least some were taken to a former penal colony. Others were said to be hospitalized. I'm Karen Chamas.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says victory in his country's ongoing war with Russia will ultimately come through a diplomatic settlement. He made the comment in a TV interview late on Friday. U.S. President Joe Biden and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol have signaled a stronger military posture amid a series of recent North Korean missile test launches and a potential nuclear test. The president said at a news conference on Saturday that he and South Korean President Yoon are committed to strengthening the close engagement between the two countries. He said that agreement includes addressing the threat posed by North Korea. Biden is on a first stop of a six-day trip to South Korea and Japan. A new poll shows President Biden's approval rating dipped to the lowest point of his presidency in May, deepening pessimism emerging among members of his own Democratic Party. Contributed to those numbers, only 39% of U.S. adults approve of Biden's performance as president. This according to an AP poll. From Washington, you're listening to VOA News. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat on Saturday after an election. Partial results show the opposition Labor Party is set to end almost a decade of conservative rule. Pro-environment independents may have played a role in the vote's outcome. Partial results showed Morrison's Liberal National Coalition had been punished by voters in Western Australia and affluent urban seats in particular. Labor has yet to reach the 76 of 151 lower house seats required to form a government alone. Final results could take time as counting of a record number of postal votes is completed. Shanghai cautiously pushed ahead on Saturday with plans to restore part of its transportation network in a major step toward exiting a weeks-long COVID-19 lockdown, while Beijing kept up its defenses in an outbreak that has persisted for a month. Shanghai's lockdown since the beginning of April has dealt a heavy economic blow to China's most populous city. It stirred debate over the sustainability of the nation's zero-COVID policy and stoked fears of future lockdowns and disruptions. U.S. officials are warning of a COVID supply rationing, COVID vaccine supply rationing without more funds. AP's Jennifer King has that story.
White House officials have been warning for weeks that the country has spent most of the money set aside for COVID response. Coronavirus coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha is using dire language like rationing and contingency plans to describe what will happen if Congress doesn't approve more funds soon. Tests, vaccines, and therapeutics would become harder to come by as stockpiles are depleted, with new supplies sold overseas before Americans can access them. Vaccines might have to be once again restricted to the most vulnerable. Domestic rapid test manufacturers who ramped up in the midst of the surge are already laying off workers. And Jha says some expect to sell off equipment and get out of the test-making business, leaving the U.S. more dependent on overseas suppliers. The White House said this week the U.S. has yet to start negotiations with drug makers to place orders for an expected fall surge because of the lack of money. Jennifer King, Washington.
A spokesman for Thailand's negotiating team says its just-ended truce with insurgents in the country's deep south was a success. A spokesman for the government's negotiating team told VOA that it hopes to settle the rules of a long-term ceasefire by the end of the year. Ethnic Malay Muslims, rebels in a Buddhist-majority Thailand, are fighting for independence for the country's three southernmost provinces. And recapping our top stories this hour, Russia claims to have captured Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine after nearly a three-month siege that left more than 20,000 civilians feared dead. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
I think that the problems that we are facing as a country, they are not, these are not mere problems between a ruling party and an opposition political parties. These are problems of Ugandans.
Expectations are high as Ugandans await President Yoweri Museveni's nation address Sunday.
Government for the ruling party to have a negotiation, to have a dialogue with the opposition political parties, specifically Chadema. So we are seeing them opening up. So let's go and see if they are really genuine or they are just doing a lip service. We can make a conclusion after meeting them.
Talks between Tanzania's ruling party and the main opposition party, Chadema, are set to begin at the end of the month.
The SME ministry, the new investments, such as the one which has come through with through SQM, are those that are going to cushion some of these early shocks that may be received while we stabilize the investment environment in Zambia.
And Zambia's Minister for Labor and Social Security says the administration is recruiting teachers and nurses before the end of the year. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Expectations are high as Ugandans await President Yoweri Museveni's nation address scheduled for Sunday. Linda Nabusai, the special presidential press secretary, says President Museveni will address the nation about the economic situation in the country. The address, officials say, will be broadcast on television and radio stations as well as on social media platforms. It comes as opposition and civil society groups call on the government to resolve what they say are the escalating prices of goods and services. For analysis and expectations of the president's speech to the nation, I reached Godbert Tumushabi. He is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist.
In my view, there is nothing much that you can really expect that is new, given the conditions that we are facing. Secondly, we are a country that is deeply in debt. Our revenues are very low. Our budget is largely dependent on borrowing and foreign grants. Our tax-to-GDP ratio is just around 14% of GDP. So the government has no financial flexibility to be able to make any interventions of whatever nature to be able to ameliorate the problems that the population is facing. So I really don't have any much expectation that he would say anything new other than explaining the problems, which he does most of the time.
Well, some people are suggesting that since a lot of Ugandans have expressed concern about the sharp rise in goods and services in Uganda, it is just appropriate for the president to assure the nation about his government's plan to try to reduce the burden on the average Ugandan. They expect that the president will try to come out with some solutions to resolve their concerns. Your thoughts?
The current situation is very tough, Peter, to tell you. Right now we are in the school opening season. I know many parents who are going through a tough situation, getting kids back to school. There are many, many kids right now that are not yet back in school because they can't pay fees. So the situation is very, very tough, I can tell you. Because you see, for a country to have to expand the range of policy tools to intervene, it must have been organizing itself and planning for these kinds of eventualities. For Mr. Mseven's government is a government that runs a huge patronage network of elected and non-elected leaders. So he doesn't have the flexibility. Even if he wanted to do it, he doesn't have the flexibility to be able to make the kinds of interventions that would be needed to ameliorate the current situation that citizens are faced with.
Are you therefore saying Ugandans who are expecting him to talk about healthcare delivery, service delivery, apart from the pressures, which a lot of people are saying, economies of every country is being impacted due to ongoing world events, and that it will be unfair to criticize the government for world events that have sharply affected the economy. They also talked about, they expect the president to talk about cheap substitute to hike commodities. Your thoughts?
I totally agree that some of the causes, some of the commodity prices here are really triggered by the ongoing global events, the war in Ukraine, its impact on fuel prices. We know that Malaysia just changed its policy and saying it's adding, it has to add value to its palm oil production, palm oil raw materials. So that means that you would have cooking oil in Uganda or anywhere around the world, the price is going up. So in other words, I can fully understand. I am only saying that the government should be in a position to mitigate the costs of school fees, mitigate costs of healthcare, mitigate costs of, you know, there are a range of things that you can do which are within our means than the global events that that affect everybody.
Recently, we've seen a former main opposition leader and presidential candidate, Chisa Beseje, wanting to go on demonstration and to call on the attention of the government to resolve the escalating prices of goods and services in Uganda. Some are wondering why other opposition political parties are not joining him in this, since they have also been complaining about the sharp rise in commodities. What are your views about that?
I think that the situation in Uganda is a difficult situation. So first of all, the reason you don't see people in Uganda protesting is not because they are happy of the situation. So you have to factor in the question of fear. Secondly, I think that the problems that we are facing as a country, these are not mere problems between a ruling party and an opposition political parties. These are problems of Ugandans.
Godbertu Mushabe is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In
Tanzania, talks between the ruling Chama Chama Pinduzi and the main opposition Chadema are scheduled to begin at the end of the month. Analysts say the move signals a shift in policy of President Samia Suluhu Hassan to engage the biggest opposition party. It came after the president held talks with Freeman Mbowe, national chairman of the main opposition party, shortly after he was released from jail. Chadema petitioned President Hassan for a meeting to help ease political tensions in the East African country. For the latest development and expectations of the much-anticipated dialogue between the ruling CCM and the main opposition party Chadema, I read John Rema. He is the Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema.
Since when Freeman Mbowe was freed, he just went straight to the State House by the invitation of the President Samia Suluhu Hassan, and that's where we started initiating a dialogue between Chadema, the ruling party, and the government. And they have been there last week, again, for the same purpose, and they agreed that we have to form teams for dialogue. Chadema should submit a team of not less than 10 people, and the government and the ruling party will submit the team as well. So we're expecting to hold the dialogue at the end of this month between Chadema, the ruling party, and the government on the other side.
Chadema has been seeking to have a dialogue with the president for a long time. How do you feel about this acceptance to meet you, and what are some of the major issues that you seek to address?
It is true that we have been waiting since the year 2020, April, when Freeman Mbowe written a letter to the late President John Magufuli about the need to have a dialogue to discuss what transpired in the 2020 general election in the country. But Magufuli never responded until he died last year. So when Samia Suluhu Hassan, the new president, accepted that, we saw that as a new government wanting to have a dialogue with us. So it's a thing we've been waiting for so long. The major issues we are expecting to go and discuss is about, the first issue is about what transpired in the 2020 general election, why that election was so badly rigged. But the other issue is the need to have a new constitution for the country. This is a major issue. And also we have proposed that we have to sit and discuss about the need to form a truth and reconciliation committee for the country, because so many things happened for the last 6 years during the Magufuli time. We have to bring these people together. So many people have suffered in this country, from political leaders, politicians, businessmen, farmers, even to the fishermen. So everybody, we want to bring this nation together. So those are the three major issues we want to talk to the president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, and not forget about the need to have an independent electoral commission, so that in the coming elections, we want to go back to the 2020 election where everything was rigged. So those are the main issues we are going to put on the table and discuss with the government and the ruling party on the other side.
If the government decides that a new constitution, as you are demanding, is a non-starter, during the dialogue, will this be a dialogue breaker? Will this be a no-go area that without talking about the demand for a new constitution, the talks cannot proceed?
We are going to bring on the table a make or break issue when we are going to meet in the first meeting. So for the time being, I can't say which is going to be a make or break issue, but we are going to bring them on the table on our first meeting, so that if they will say that they don't want that, then it is a break from the very start. So for now, we have agreed on various issues which are make or break, but I can't reveal it right now. We are going to reveal it when we meet at the first meeting with the president and his team from the other side of the ruling party and the government.
What are your expectations ahead of the much anticipated meeting between the ruling party and your party?
We are expecting to have a dialogue, genuine one, because even the ruling party vice chairman, Abrahamani Kinana, he has said that there is a need for the government, for the ruling party, to have a negotiation, to have a dialogue with the opposition political party, specifically Chadema. So we are seeing them opening up. So let's go and see if they are really genuine or they are just doing a lip service. We can make a conclusion after meeting them.
Following the announcement that you will be meeting them, what were some of the reactions from members of your party?
Some members of our party, because they have been living in this situation of them being jailed, being sent to the police all the time. Some of them doesn't see the genuinity from the other side. But the leaders are trying to tell them that let's give them an olive branch. If they'll break it, it's up to them and not up to us. So it is true that some of our members are scared about it, but let's wait and see.
John Mrema is the Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition party, CHADEMA. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Zambia's Minister for Labour and Social Security says President Hakainde Hichilema's administration has implemented measures to recruit 30,000 teachers and 11,000 nurses before the end of the year. Brenda Tambatamba also says he has created an enabling business environment to encourage Zambians to invest as well as attract foreign investors in sectors of the economy, including mining. Her remarks follow President Hakainde Hichilema's call for a concerted effort to improve the operating environment of the mining sector. His call came during a speech at the annual African Mining in Durba recently held in Cape Town, South Africa. For more on the labor market in Zambia, I reach Brenda Tambatamba via Skype. She is Zambia's labor and social security minister.
The New Dawn government has immediately launched into the recommitment and getting back to the voters with the deliverable of jobs, and not just jobs, but meaningful jobs. And certainly, the larger population of those that are to benefit from these jobs are young people. At our first budget, the New Dawn government of His Excellency, the President, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema, did announce the jobs, the first initiative, which was about sourcing funds to pick up on the backlog of recruitment for both the education and health sectors, the two critical sectors, so service delivery, education and health. And pronouncements were made to the extent that close to 44,000 jobs would be made available to ensure there'll be an uptake from the numbers to begin to unclog the numbers of those who are coming out of college. And so that is the first practical, most practical thing a responsible government does.
You know, the mining industry employs a lot of Zambians, from the youth to the elderly. There are fears that the mining companies have been sacking or shedding employees. How do you respond to such concerns?
I think first and foremost, before I even jump to that particular one, I think it's important to see a government that is operating methodically, delivering on its commitments methodically. But the SME ministry, the small and medium enterprise ministry, a new ministry has been formed. And that too was meant to target the employment of the youth, upskilling them in entrepreneurship, for them to begin to become future employers or self-employers who become future employers. So that too is a mechanism combined with the CDF that has been put in place, an unprecedented quantum leap from somewhere 1.6 million kwachas to 25.7 million that has been unleashed, bearing in mind that this would create jobs through the SME enterprises that are being chaperoned, coached, and mentored through that new ministry, but at the front line in the rural areas that have been ignored for many, many years. The government of the president, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema, has already put a cushion, buffer zone, ensuring that people have got an opportunity to create employment for themselves. So this is a social safety net. This is social security that is being provided to ensure that we're doing some things for ourselves before we start thinking about what the mining companies are going to provide. Any mining company that will let go people will have to come to this ministry and other relevant ministries like mines ministry, commerce, and the three different ministries. We'll work with them to find the best way to be a corporate citizen that takes care that you do not throw out people without due attention of where they're going to go. So those who may come out of there, of those redundancies, we still have a social safety net, a social security package of what I've described here.
I was about to ask you about the president's speech at the Indaba, Mines conference. Now, specifically with what the president spoke about, how does that practically influence the job creation in Zambia?
FQM, you have heard amongst the announcements that have been made in South Africa. We have a corporate citizen that is on the Zambian mining industry scenario. They are running two mines, large scale. Two of the five large scale mines in Zambia are run by FQM. FQM has just announced the $1.3 billion to begin to reinvest, to expand, because of the good climate environment for investment that has been created by the New Dawn government. That too is another port that will be able to assist us to take on, to absorb some of those who may be coming from some of those redundancies. So we, as a government, are well coordinated to track, monitor, and ensure that we manage those dynamics that are taking place, where there's some that are out of one window. We have windows that are open, tunnels that are open to absorb the other ones. So the CDF, the SME ministry, the new investments, such as the one which has come through with the through FQM, are those that are going to cushion some of these early shocks that may be received while we stabilize the investment environment in Zambia.
Brenda Tambatamba is Zambia's Labour and Social Security Minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. European Union election observers say Zimbabwe risks having another disputed election next year unless it ensures the country's election body is independent of the government and ruling party. For VOA Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital Harare, free fair elections are a condition that Western countries have set for lifting sanctions imposed for alleged election rigging 20 years ago.
Elmer Brook, the head of the EU Electoral Mission, told reporters Friday that as Zimbabwe prepares for next year's elections, it must amend its electoral laws so that all parties have a fair chance of winning at the polls. Brook and his team were assigned to Zimbabwe by Brussels to share their findings after their first visit to Zimbabwe during the July 2018 elections. In an interview with VOA, Brook, a German national, said the mission gave Zimbabwean officials 23 recommendations for genuine electoral reforms.
It has to do with an equal playing field, impartiality and of media, equal treatment of the parties, the proper voters' registration. So there's multi-party liaison committee, the commission. There will be a proper conduct of elections, the conduct on election day, the transparency, and then counting and the collection of the counts to the final results. If that is transparent and clear and no loopholes, then is that the best way to have peace in a country? Because nobody can say there was something which was wrong with the elections. To get credibility of election.
Zimbabwe officials would not comment Friday on Brook's statement. Earlier, though, Rafael Faranisi, the acting permanent secretary in Zimbabwe's Foreign Affairs Ministry, said the government is looking forward to June 7 when Harare and Brussels officials meet.
This will be yet another opportunity to candidly assess progress to date and plan for the future based on realistic expectations. I've heard the concerns expressed with respect to developments in Zimbabwe, but I just wish to put it at record that in terms of the reforms that we've carried out, the challenge is, I just want you to give me 3, 4, 5 countries on our continent that have really done better than us. For those who have been following closely developments in Zimbabwe, we are on that reform trajectory and it's not reversible.
For years, Zimbabwe's elections have been marred by violence, voter intimidation, and allegations of rigging, leading to disputed results. When President Emmerson Mnangagwa succeeded Robert Mugabe in 2017, Mnangagwa promised to improve how elections are held, but the opposition continues to accuse the ruling ZANU-PF party and the government of manipulating the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the political pressure group Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law has petitioned Western embassies to impose a ban on prominent Nigerians who promote religious intolerance. The group says that includes those who have publicly supported the recent murder of Deborah Samuel for alleged blasphemy. Samuel was a student of Shehu Shagari College Education in Sokoto, Northwest Nigeria. She was killed and her remains torched by students for allegedly making a statement described by her attackers as blasphemy against the Prophet Muhammad. Her killing drew sharp condemnation from President Muhammadu Buhari, Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, and a host of prominent Nigerians and religious leaders. Civil society and political parties are demanding the prosecution of those responsible for Samuel's death. For more on the petition to the Western Embassy, I reach Deji Adeyanju. He is the convener of Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law.
The constitution is the supreme law of the country. Several courts all over the country said any other law that is made in contravention or in conflict with the constitution, that law will be null and void. You know, so the spirit and the constitution means, you know, the beginning and end of all laws in Nigeria. So that is the foundation of our petition, to say that, you know, this whole idea of escalating the alleged blasphemy and taking the laws into the hands by the perpetrators of our killers was wrong. Then those who have come to give life and justification for it, that there must be consequences for that bad behavior, you know, and this is the long perceived notion by some people that it is right and just to take the law into your hand.
How many foreign missions did you send or did your group send these petitions to? And why are you singling out those two? Because some people argue that a number of people from the north have come out in support of the attack on Miss Samuels.
So if you look, our petition is supported by the media publications. You know, so we relied on the media publication, which gained a lot of followership and interest to base our petition. That is why we told the embassy, we said, attached is the evidence of their support and the reactions it has generated. You know, so that's just the only reason, nothing else.
Some people are saying your petition undermines the very constitution that you say you are protecting, because the constitution guarantees freedom of speech. So if they are expressing their freedom of speech, why call on foreign embassies to clamp down on them? They argue. What is your response to that?
Yes, you see, if you put Section 10 in the face of Section 36, you know, and yes, Section 36 guarantees the freedom, but you can see what Section 36, what the omnibus clause is, that there are certain exceptions to all the fundamental rights enshrined in Chapter 4. You know, the exceptions are simple. The exceptions are that, you know, in terms of public health, public safety, public morality, you know, also protection of other persons, other people, you know, then issue of, for instance, maybe there's COVID, you know, movements are restricted. So those are the issues, the simple issues. No, nobody is saying they do not have the right to express their views. However, we are saying that by expressing and supporting her mother, you know, what they are simply doing is they are giving impetus to the act, which is wrong, which even the president himself has condemned. You understand? And neither are we saying whether the alleged blaspheming was true or whether we are saying that the alleged blaspheming was justified. No. We are saying the law should have allowed to take its course. People should not come and justify jungle justice, which is what the president condemned, which is what we are condemning. And we are saying these people ought to have known. They ought to have known better, you know, and these kind of things is capable of getting many people to engage in jungle justice, and there'll be many more victims.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. National Day on May 20 has been marked by running battles between government troops and separatists who impose a lockdown, crippling businesses in English-speaking Western regions. The military says at least 28 separatists who vowed to disrupt celebrations in English-speaking regions of the majority Francophone nation were killed in violent battles. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, where President Paul Biya is attending commemorations.
Cameroon's military sings at a ceremony to commemorate May 20 in the capital, Yaoundé, pledging loyalty to state institutions and expressing the readiness of troops to defend the country's territorial integrity. The government said the parade marking Cameroon's 50th National Day was attended by at least 30,000 civilians led by President Paul Biya. The government said it reduced the time for the military parade to 45 minutes for strategic reasons. However, opposition political parties, including the Social Democratic Front, said the ailing 89-year-old Biya could not stand up for 2 hours to honor the military during its parade, as has been the tradition in Cameroon. The government said the National Day celebration was successful in Cameroon's French-speaking regions. Separatists said they imposed a lockdown in English-speaking Western regions to protest May 20 celebrations, also known as the Day of National Unity between the English-speaking minority and the majority French-speaking nation. Capo Daniel is Deputy Defense Chief of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, which Cameroon officials call a leading separatist group. He says fighters stopped government troops from transporting French speakers to English-speaking Western regions to give the impression that English speakers are happy with the central government in Yaoundé. Kapu says in the process, many government troops were killed.
Previously, we have seen the Cameroon government drive into our territory, her own citizens, to stage public celebration of the 20th May. For this year, 2022, we have targeted Cameroon forces, killing over 24 of them. Across Ambazonia, our forces have signaled their presence to our population by firing shots in the air to send a message that today everyone should stay at home and observe a rejection of the Cameroon union with Ambazonia.
Ambazonia is what separatists call the state they say they are fighting to create. The government has denied its troops were transporting French speakers to English-speaking regions. The military says it lost 6 troops in battles within the past week and that 28 separatists who tried to disrupt May 20 activities were killed in several northwestern towns, including Oku, Kumbu, Bamenda, and Kambe. Colonel Samuel Talbot Orok is a commander of government troops fighting separatists in Bamenda, the capital of Cameroon's English-speaking northwest region. Orok says the military made sure everyone who came out for celebrations was protected.
Let the world, and Cameroon in particular, understand that the military in Bamenda know that the secessionist fighters will be doing everything in their powers to disrupt the successful 20th May celebration. That's why we are taking every single measure, as far as security is concerned, to make sure there is a hitch-free 20th May celebration in Bamenda.
Orok said running battles between government troops and separatists crippled activity in many northwestern towns and villages. The government said prior to the day, at least 35 people, separatists suspected of preparing to commemorate the day, were abducted by separatists in several towns of the southwest region, including Mutengene and Tiku. Bernard Okalia Bilai, the governor of the southwest region, spoke by telephone from Boya, capital of the region. Bilai says local administrative authorities and civilians report separatists who abduct and threaten to kill people accused of disrespecting lockdown calls to the military. He says civilians have understood that separatist claims that fighters can create an independent English-speaking state in Cameroon are unfounded. On May 20, 1972, Cameroon organized what it called a constitutional referendum, during which a majority of its citizens voted to abolish the federal system of government that had existed since 1961 in favor of a unitary state. Separatists say there has been an overbearing influence of French in English-speaking Western regions since the 1972 referendum. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
But before we get into that, I'm going to play you some amazing music.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
For Instagram, we met. We come to tell lovers. We come to change number. Super. As it a day go like this, it a day got something, yo. A very big something, for real, for real. So baby, come let me protect you, and I go try not to offend you. For you, I need to commando. I know be tap right they come and go. You need come and get that talk when you tell her. Taku tunes and taku better. Uni pechung wangu petango. Usiku tu kia fanya mambo. Cause you fine and too sweet. Ah, eh. Let's do this. Ah, eh. With two kids. Ah, I'm
Aujourd'hui. Africa ezali kontina kitoko. Africa ezali mabele ya bakoko batika. Bino bato bozali bandai boya kotala Africa. Boya na kontina Africa bokokuta biloko nyonso ezali. Africa, eh? Africa, don't you want me to see a Salina and your soul? But always, I know, but I'm not a Salina. I'm not a Salina. I'm not a Salina.
boy, Ashanti Kingdom, Shaka Zulu, and what have you?
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nigeria. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Said Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, leaves never fall into a boat that is always moving. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Marissa Melton. U.S. President Joe Biden and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol have signaled a stronger military posture ahead of amid a series of recent North Korean missile test launches and a potential nuclear test. The president said at a news conference Saturday that he and South Korean President Yoon are committed to strengthening the close engagement between the two countries. He said that agreement includes addressing the threat posed by North Korea. Biden's on the first stop of a six-day trip to South Korea and Japan. The comments came as North Korea continues working on its weapons programs with 16 missile tests this year. President Yoon said through an interpreter that Biden had confirmed what he called the ironclad U.S. commitment to defending South Korea. Pyongyang tested an intercontinental ballistic missile in March, its first in more than 4 years, and officials have warned that Pyongyang may conduct additional missile or even nuclear tests while Biden is in Asia. The two leaders said after meeting that they will consider expanded joint military exercises to deter the nuclear threat from North Korea. VOA's Tommy McNeil has more.
The announcement during Biden's visit to Seoul reflects a shift in direction from former U.S. President Donald Trump. Trump had considered scrapping the exercises and had expressed affection for North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The announcement may also put to rest concerns in Seoul that Washington would revert to the Obama administration's policy of strategic patience, in which it largely looked the other way while North Korea expanded its nuclear arsenal. Tommy McNeil, VOA News, Washington.
More on Biden's trip to East Asia at our website, voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says victory in his country's ongoing war with Russia will ultimately come through diplomatic settlement. Zelensky made the comment in a TV interview late on Friday. The Ukraine leader also said his country is attempting to recover fighters who surrendered to Russian forces after weeks of fighting at the Azovstal steel plant in the southern port city of Mariupol. In other developments, Russia stepped up its assault on eastern Ukraine on Friday using artillery, rocket launchers, and aircraft to pound the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has details. She spoke Friday with Steve Miller, host of VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
We received official comment from the head of the Luhansk Regional Military Administration, Serhiy Haidai, who told us that Russian forces in general, according to the estimated data for the moment, so Russian forces destroyed more than 11,000 houses in the Lugansk region.
She says the city of Rubizhna has been reduced to rubble, and we also have a clip of her describing that.
We received official comment from the...
I'll bring you that sound on in another hour. We'll move on now. Officials say representatives of the United States and several other nations walked out of a meeting of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group on Saturday to protest Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Representatives from Canada, New Zealand, Japan, and Australia joined the Americans in walking out of the APEC meeting, while the Russian representative was delivering remarks at the opening of the two-day meeting. Canada says wireless carriers in the country won't be allowed to install Huawei equipment in their high-speed 5G networks. In announcing the decision this week, Canada joined the United States and other allies that previously banned the giant Chinese technology company. The U.S. government has been lobbying allies for years to exclude Huawei from the new ultra-fast 5G mobile networks over worries that China's communist rulers could compel the company to help with cyber espionage. The U.S. has warned that it will reconsider intelligence sharing with any countries that use Huawei gear. The company has repeatedly denied the allegations. And once again, recapping our top story this hour, U.S. President Joe Biden and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol have signaled a stronger military posture amid a series of recent North Korea missile test launches and a possible nuclear test. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA executive producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Welcome, Steve, and welcome, Kane. This is your first time joining us on the show.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, here are the issues. The political sway of former U.S. President Donald Trump over Republican Party politics was tested again in the most dramatic night so far in this election cycle as his preferred candidates faced off with Republican opponents in party primaries in key states. President Joe Biden declared that last weekend's mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, in which a white teenage gunman allegedly killed 10 black people at a grocery store in a racist rampage, was domestic terrorism. Biden briefly revived a long-running appeal for federal gun legislation, including a ban on assault weapons. However, Republicans oppose additional federal gun restrictions, and Democrats need at least 10 Republicans to vote with them in the Senate to overcome any legislative filibuster to pass most legislation. The EU's efforts to impose a new round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine appears to be tougher than expected as a small group of countries continue to oppose a ban on Russian oil imports. Finland and Sweden have officially applied for membership in the NATO military alliance. Here in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, says the number of counties considered to be at high risk of spreading COVID has almost tripled in the last 2 weeks. A new Gallup survey suggests many Americans are no longer wearing masks and social distancing, sparking concerns that ignoring health protocols will prolong the pandemic. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, high-profile battles were fought in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, while voters in Idaho, Kentucky, and Oregon also went to the polls. How will these primaries shape the Republican and Democratic parties as we look ahead to the midterms?
All of the primaries are being watched for two things. One, how strong a grip does former President Donald Trump have on the Republican Party? He has endorsed candidates across the board in many, not just at the very top of the ballots, but many down ballot and in many statewide only elections, he's endorsed some candidates. So we're watching that. And we're also watching on the Democratic side, which part of the Democratic Party is going to be stronger in this election cycle, the progressive side or the more moderate side. And we're seeing in many of these primary elections that on the Republican side, Trump still has a hold on the party. And on the Democratic side, the progressives are making some gains against the moderates. So that's what we're seeing so far and what we're looking at so far.
Yeah, former President Donald Trump wants to make this midterm election race and the primary races that lead up to that a referendum on him. And I think with maybe a couple of notable exceptions, he's proving that he does have influence on the Republican base and on the voters who are turning out for these primary elections, with the exception of a congressional race in North Carolina, that's Madison Cawthorn, and then also the Idaho governor's race. The lieutenant governor in Idaho was a Trump-backed candidate, and she was defeated in the primary race there. But other than that, I think many of the candidates that Donald Trump has publicly endorsed have been successful in reaching those Republican-based voters who vote in those primary elections.
One of the things, though, in many of those victories, not all of them, but many of them, especially the ones where there are multiple candidates in the race. Let's take a look at Pennsylvania, for instance. In Pennsylvania, we have a television doctor, Dr. Mehmet Oz, who is slightly ahead of former hedge fund CEO David McCormick, both of whom are Republicans, both of whom appealed to Donald Trump for his endorsement, asked Trump to give his endorsement. And there was another candidate who also parroted a lot of former President Trump's lines about elections and fraud in elections and appeared to be very, very conservative. So there is basically a three-way race in Pennsylvania. Dr. Oz got Trump's endorsement about a month or so ago. And so far, he's got a very slight lead over McCormick. And the third candidate, Kathy Barnett, is also running strong. So there's almost a three-way split in the votes. And if you look at other races so far this primary season, Trump-backed candidates in a multiple, if it's more than one candidate, are only getting about 30 to 33% of the Republican vote in these primaries. While Trump-backed candidates are maybe winning, they're not necessarily getting a majority of the votes among Republicans. So that's something that we want to watch through the rest of the primary season.
Also, too, the claims of election fraud continue in these primary races, unfounded claims, illegitimate claims of election fraud from the 2020 presidential election. And this three-way race that Steve has mentioned in Pennsylvania right now is so close that it could, in fact, trigger a recount in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's election code requires the Secretary of State to order all county boards of their elections to conduct a recount if the leading candidate isn't ahead by 0.5%. And that's how close it is in those races there. So what's going to wind up happening if the results, when they're tallied, don't give a candidate a lead of more than 0.5%, there's going to have to be a recount. And I think that's only going to fuel these unfounded and inaccurate claims of election fraud. And some of that's already starting to bleed into the results as they're being tallied here over the last couple of days.
When you look at races such as the one in Pennsylvania, where it is very, very close, what is that really saying about voters? What are voters looking for in these candidates?
Well, we have to remember that typically in these primary races, it's the party faithful that turn out to vote. You know, this is not an election that's indicative of, say, a presidential election when, you know, the general population, the most amount of voters turn out to vote. So these are highly motivated, in many cases, political partisans who want to make sure that their candidate is the one who is represented heading into a general midterm election for the Senate and congressional races that are up this year. It's reflective of the party base, the voters of that party, but it is not necessarily reflective of the general electorate in those areas, such as those states or those congressional districts. So, you know, turnout in these elections won't be as high as they might be in the general election for these midterm elections in November, and certainly not like they would be in a presidential election.
One of the things that we're noticing is those people who are, quote, never Trumpers, who oppose Donald Trump within the Republican Party, are losing. They are not winning their races for the most part in these three-way matches or these multiple candidate matches. What it's showing is kind of the fissures that there are within the Republican Party between those who support Donald Trump and those who want to move on from Donald Trump.
Another thing to remember here also is that, you know, there is some analysis that shows that we have become more polarized as an electorate, and even so within a party base. So Steve just mentioned never Trumpers, and that would be a faction of the Republican Party that simply will never vote for Donald Trump or accept Donald Trump's brand of politics, which also is sometimes referred to as Trumpism. But there is some indication, especially in the results of the 2020 presidential election, that there are many of those people who might describe themselves as a never Trumper that have moved to the Democratic Party. These people, they might have voted Republican in the past, but were turned off by Donald Trump. Well, they're not voting in these Republican primaries now. They could either be voting as a Democrat in the Democratic primaries, or they're independents who might just be waiting to see how these primaries shape up, and they will vote in the midterm election and then obviously in the general election. It's also notable to point out, and Steve, you'll have to help me out with the numbers here. I mean, I think Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election actually won the popular vote by more than 8 million votes. Am I right with that?
Close, yes.
And there was over 150 million votes cast, right?
Yes.
When we look at those massive numbers in a presidential election, these numbers, when we're talking about tens and hundreds of thousands of voters in each state or each congressional district turning out to vote, is not necessarily representative of how, say, maybe the next presidential election is going to shape up. But another thing that's also notable that I wanted to add, we talk about Donald Trump's influence on the Republican Party an awful lot. It's interesting because he's making news by endorsing candidates. But what we don't notice is news made by Joe Biden endorsing candidates on the Democratic side. I guess it remains to be seen whether or not Joe Biden's endorsement would either help or hurt a candidate as they're heading into the midterm elections, but certainly not covered in the news, or it doesn't make for television Joe Biden making an endorsement announcement or showing up to campaign for that person as Donald Trump does.
Yes, and also we have in Pennsylvania, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman winning the Democratic Senate primary. So what does this win mean for progressive Democrats?
It's an important win for progressive Democrats. Fetterman was aligned with Bernie Sanders in the 2020 election. Sanders was Biden's chief competition and is a very progressive, self-described socialist. But Fetterman has got a popularity part of his appeal. He's a giant man. He's about 6'8", very imposing, tattooed and shaved head, and comes across as very much of a populist, almost in a way that Donald Trump did during the 2016 election campaign. He is going to be a very formidable candidate against whichever of the Republicans win. One other thing that I want to note about Pennsylvania is that there's a Republican candidate for governor, a guy named Doug Mastriano, who is a state senator. He is an unabashed believer in Trump's false narrative that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. A few days before the primary election, Trump endorsed him once he saw he was likely to win. The importance here is that whoever is elected governor will have a say in how the 2024 election, presidential election, turns out. And Democrats are so sure that this guy, Doug Mastriano, is a damaged candidate that they took out TV ads in order to prop him up for the primary for him to win. They believe that they can defeat him for governor.
I want to dovetail on something that Stephen said about Fetterman's candidacy. So, in the interest of fullest possible disclosure, I'm originally from Pittsburgh, and that is the area that Fetterman is from. And he represents a very strong working class background. You know, he comes from a family that lived in an area where the steel mills were the primary employer of the people, the working class people who lived in the area. In 2016, Donald Trump appealed to voters in what we now call the Rust Belt, which is the industrial part of America that many people who lived there feel is forgotten. They were the workforce of America, the people who went to the steel mills and to the manufacturing plants to work, which have seen job losses, erosion of their workforce, erosion of union protections and union strength. And so Donald Trump appealed to those voters. He was the person who said, I alone can fix your woes, and I can help you get your jobs back, and I can help re-empower America. Fetterman, in this case, is that candidate. He is the candidate who can represent more of that idea to voters in the state of Pennsylvania, and he is not a Republican. He is a Democrat. If, in fact, Dr. Oz is the person who winds up winning the Republican primary, it'll be an interesting dynamic to see how all of these messages wind up shaping the race for the Senate seat in Pennsylvania and how much that's going to influence voter turnout.
Yes, it's really good analysis that you both did on these primaries that have been taking place. But want to move on now to our next topic. President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden traveled to Buffalo, New York, to mourn with the relatives of those killed by a gunman who allegedly drove 200 miles to the grocery store where he shot and killed 10 people. Biden called for U.S. citizens to unite against white supremacy. While many people lose their lives every day due to senseless murders, should U.S. citizens be more concerned about the shootings that are fueled by racism?
I guess I'm just going to be honest here and explain that I've covered too many of these myself as a correspondent for Voice of America. I covered a shooting here in Illinois. I covered the shooting of the Sikh community in Wisconsin. We continue to have these issues. And when another one of these incidents happens, it's like history repeating itself, and there doesn't seem to be meaningful solutions that address the root causes of these shootings. yes, we should all be concerned. We should be more concerned. Americans should be more engaged and active in trying to prevent these things from happening in their communities. And it isn't really, you know, up to one segment, one community, one race, one gender. I mean, this is an effort that requires unification on the part of Americans to address it. There also needs to be a way to stop the radicalization of the people who engage in these activities online. If there was a clear answer to how to fix these problems, somebody would have stepped forward and done it already. But something has to be done. Somebody has to have the answer. Somebody has to come forward with meaningful action and meaningful solutions that can help not only prevent it, but you have to repair some of the damage that's been done between these communities. It's not just a matter of preventing it the next time. There has to be a tremendous amount of effort to help the country heal.
Unfortunately, this kind of gun violence has become just another part of American life. Most Americans do not own a gun. Fewer than 50% of Americans have a gun in their household. According to the latest Gallup poll, 52% of Americans favor stricter gun laws. 4 years ago, in 2018, 67% of Americans favored stricter gun laws. Now it's 52%. I don't have a really good explanation as to why that number has dropped so precipitously in just 4 years.
Well, also to Steve, to your point, that number has dropped while the influence of the major gun lobby in America, the National Rifle Association, the NRA, has effectively been weakened in that time. They are not as strong as they used to be. I think they were on the verge of declaring bankruptcy. They've become almost an impotent lobbying organization while they've had to sort out their financial woes. So that number has decreased while the influence of the chief lobbyist for the group has also waned.
Yet despite the decrease in the National Rifle Association's power, there still isn't enough political will in Congress to toughen the gun laws. As you mentioned, Kim, in the open, Democrats who want to strengthen the gun laws need 10 Republican senators to come over to their side in order to just get a vote on stricter gun laws. So it doesn't appear that Congress is going to act anytime soon. The shooting in Buffalo happened in a state that has one of the most strict gun laws in the country, and yet this stuff keeps happening. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for that.
And I also think there is some indication that this shooter in Buffalo had signaled what was going to happen online prior to it occurring. There was also some troubling signals that he was exhibiting with his behavior in school and leading up to the shooting. The question now is, were some of the concerns about his behavior and his intentions dismissed prior to this tragedy? Is there more that can be done to monitor this kind of behavior and maybe have an intervention before things like this occur? I think that's a part of the discussion now that's being framed in the wake of this tragedy.
And it's a discussion that is difficult to have because mental health is not just here in America, but worldwide, is an issue that is difficult to tackle. Because of American culture, it is difficult to intervene in someone else's issues.
That is so true, and we'll have to end the discussion on that topic for the sake of time. And it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, why the newest round of sanctions on Russia may be tough to pull off. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest Correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Well, in our next topic, the EU's efforts to impose a new round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine appears to be tougher than expected as a small group of countries continue to oppose a ban on Russian oil imports. For instance, Hungary is one landlocked EU country that is highly dependent on Russian oil, along with the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Bulgaria has also reservations. So how is the EU going to get around these hurdles, especially with Russia continuing to make money from these countries?
That's a really good question, how the European Union is going to try and deal with this, because so much of its energy comes from Russia. One third of the European Union's consumption of natural gas comes from Russia. 1/4 of the European Union's oil imports come from Russia. The United States, before all of this began in Ukraine, had been trying to get the Middle East and the Gulf region, Emirates and countries, to help backfill any needs that the Europeans might have. That said, getting them off of Russian gas, which is easy to transport to the European Union, getting them off of Russian gas and oil is going to be an even longer process. And now that the Ukrainians seem to be at least holding the Russians to a stalemate, if not winning the battle on the field, it may be a little bit longer before the European Unions, especially those countries that you mentioned, give in to a Russian oil embargo.
I think right now what the plan is, at least on the part of the European Union, is you can't turn off the tap instantly and all at one time. It looks like the European Union is gravitating towards a sort of phased or oil embargo in which it tries to gradually shrink Russia's energy income. I guess what the European Union is hoping to do by doing this, it's going to be phased pain, so to speak, in trying to figure out how to deal with the loss of those imports. It won't all happen at one time. There could perhaps be an effort to find different sources of production for that. That's the difficulty, though. I mean, right now, when you have an established route and you have established means to get it there, it's not just easy to turn off the tap and redirect the supply from somewhere else.
Finland and Sweden have officially applied for membership in the NATO military alliance. So what will these two countries bring to the table?
A seismic change in the makeup of NATO. Finland and Sweden have been neutral throughout the Cold War, effectively, and joining NATO from Russia's northern border, almost to its southern border with Europe, it will primarily contain NATO countries, with the exception now of Belarus and Ukraine and Georgia. This is exactly what Vladimir Putin did not want to have happen, you know, at least publicly that he stated, is why he was invading Ukraine. And so now to have this happen, it definitely changes the order in Europe, I guess, to protect Europe from future aggression by the Russians.
Especially in Finland, which adds another 1,300 kilometers of border that Russia now has with NATO. And Finland fought a war against Russia back in the late 1930s. And ceded some land to the Soviet Union in order to end the war. They see that possibility that Russia will look at Finland much the same way it looked at Ukraine, that Russia used to have parts of Finland. And Finland, I think, was really spooked by the attack on Ukraine and believed that it was vulnerable. I see this as a big gain for NATO and yet more losses for Russia.
For both Sweden and Finland, this decision to join NATO happened at striking speed. There's been very little public discourse about it or general debate about their membership in it. It happened very quickly, and it's moving now in a process that's also moving along very quickly. It just shows how concerned these countries are about their security.
Absolutely. And I wanted to get our last topic in. Health officials report a spike in the new Omicron subvariant of COVID cases here in the U.S. So I just wanted to quickly get your thoughts on this new spread of COVID. The people I've talked to, it's a personal decision on whether they're wearing a mask or not, or to practice social distancing.
Here in the Midwest of the United States, and particularly in the state of Illinois where I live, we've had some of the most strict mask mandates and COVID protections put in place in the previous 2 years. It was about 2 or 3 months ago that the mask mandate here in the state of Illinois was lifted. I can tell you just by where I live, the general feeling among the population here is that it is a personal choice. I think there's a lot of people who are just unwilling to be forced to wear a mask or to curb their activities or to prevent from large public gatherings. And I think the mentality here has shifted from one of protection to one of management, meaning that if you're concerned about contracting COVID, the personal decision you have to make is whether or not you engage in public activities or put yourself in a crowd or put yourself into a position where you could possibly be infected. Again, too, they've just announced that there is a booster. The FDA has approved a booster for children ages 5 to 11. You know, that could help increase protection or at least increase the prevention of spread.
And after 2+ years of the COVID pandemic, many Americans are ready to declare it over. Unlikely we'll see mask mandates return anytime soon. I think the biggest number to watch right now is hospitalizations. It's at its lowest level since last August, but it's ticking up. And watching hospitalizations is going to be the real key to whether or not any other government mandates come down over the next month, 3 months, 6 months.
And we're going to have to close the show on that note. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA executive producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Thank you both so much for your insights and analysis on these challenging issues. I'm Kim Lewis, and on a programming note, we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Thanks for listening to Issues in the News.
VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. In 1931, a Belgian cosmologist and Catholic priest named Georges Lemaître published a paper that proposed the beginning and subsequent rapid expansion of what is called the observable universe. It theoretically began with the cataclysmal explosion of a single atomic particle at a single point in time. Scientists have calculated that the universe began some 13.8 billion years ago. The groundwork for this hypothesis was laid in 1915 when Albert Einstein published his theory of general relativity. This premise has become popularly known as the Big Bang Theory. It was facetiously given that name by the English astronomer and astrophysicist Sir Fred Hoyle during a radio lecture. The thing is, Sir Fred Hoyle never accepted the theory as the origin of the universe. The Big Bang Theory within the scientific community is now considered the predominant model for explaining the beginning of the universe and all it contains. Edwin Hubble, the scientist for whom a NASA space telescope is named, published Hubble's Law, also called Hubble-Lemaître Law, which proposes that the universe continues to expand. In recent years, scientists have won Nobel Prizes for their work in calculating the velocity of this expansion. Over the years, since the theory was first proposed, scientists and lay people alike often question what happened before the Big Bang even took place. Some cosmologists, like today's guest, still have many questions about the original concept of the Big Bang theory, including what occurred fractions of a second before the explosive birth of the universe. My guest for today's show is William Will Kinney. He is a professor of physics at the University at Buffalo College of Arts and Sciences in Buffalo, New York. Professor Kinney is also the author of a newly released book that explores the origins of the cosmos called An Infinity of Worlds, Cosmic Inflation and the Beginning of the Universe. Will, did the universe have an actual start date?
Yes. This is one of the sort of most profound results of cosmology in the 20th century, is the realization that the universe had a beginning. And in the 21st century now, with the advent of modern precision cosmology, lots of this exciting new science that the community is doing, we've actually managed to measure the age of the universe, our universe anyway, really accurately. So we know that the universe began in a very hot, very dense initial state about 13.8 billion years ago. And the sort of measurement uncertainty in that is about 200 million years. So we're measuring it to the age of the universe within a few percent.
So how is that determined? How is the age of the universe determined?
Well, simply put, the way we measure the age of the universe is by measuring how fast it's expanding. Right. So we can measure when we look out at galaxies in the distant universe, we notice that they're all moving away from us, and they're all moving away from us with a velocity that's proportional to their distance. So the further away something is, the faster it's moving away. So that expansion rate tells us how fast the universe is getting bigger. And if we know what the universe is made of And we have determined this, at least in a general sense, that the universe is made up of normal stuff like hydrogen and helium, some mysterious stuff called dark matter that we don't really understand, but we can detect it indirectly, and some even weirder stuff called dark energy. If you put that whole cosmic cocktail together, along with the expansion rate that we measure, you can figure out exactly how old the universe was. You can run the clock backward and determine this initial age of the cosmos.
From what I understand, from what I remember, that 80% of all matter in the universe is dark energy.
About 70 to 75, yes.
Your new book, An Infinity of Worlds, you propose that before what we call the Big Bang took place, the universe underwent a cosmic expansion and doubled in size at least 80 times in a fraction of a second. Are you saying that the Big Bang itself didn't birth the universe, but the universe started growing before the explosive event took place? Could you explain that?
Well, in a way, the theory of cosmic inflation is a theory of what happened before the Big Bang. So that moment of the Big Bang, this hot, dense initial state of the universe, happened 13.8 billion years ago. But the question is, where did that come from? What set the initial conditions for the universe? And those initial conditions are very specific. The universe has to be really smooth. It has to be really big. It has to be really close to geometrically flat. Sort of the way that when you look at the Earth, the Earth locally looks flat to you because we're so much smaller than the planet. The universe as a whole looks flat to us as well. And none of these things are explained by sort of the standard Big Bang cosmology. Inflation is a theory that rectifies these deficiencies and creates it's a theory for what really happened before this moment, 13.8 billion years ago, where our universe came into existence.
And you were talking about expansion of the universe as far as measuring when the Big Bang took place. And as I'm sure you know, famed scientist Edwin Hubble proposed that the universe continues to expand. And others since then have said that the universe is expanding at a rapid rate. And some scientists have also calculated how fast the universe is expanding. Can you talk about this concept, how it was determined, how we know it's taking place at such a rapid rate, and how are scientists able to actually calculate the rate of expansion?
The way you calculate the rate of expansion is straightforward in principle. It's complicated in practice. And so what you need to do is you need to be able to look out at a distant galaxy, or preferably a whole lot of them, and first of all, measure how far away that thing is. And that's the hard part, because measuring distances to things in astronomy is really difficult. You can't stretch a ruler out. You have to use indirect methods. And so you measure how far, if you can measure how far away, say, a distant galaxy is, and then measure how fast it's moving away from us, that gives you a measure of the rate of the expansion of the universe. So the hard part is measuring how far away things are. And in particular, these measurements that have shown that the expansion of the universe is not slowing down as one might have expected, but is actually speeding up. We typically use very, very bright supernovae. So these are exploding stars that are so bright that you can see them most of the way across the observable universe at a distance of billions or tens of billions of light years. And these are what are called standard candles. They're objects whose brightness you know. So if you look at how bright it appears to be, you can infer the distance to that thing. It's sort of like if you have a 100-watt light bulb. And you look at how bright, you can tell how far away that 100-watt light bulb is by how bright it appears to be to your eye at a distance. This is the idea of a standard candle, and we can do the same thing with supernovae, which are, of course, a whole lot brighter than 100-watt light bulbs.
I'm trying to wrap my head around what you describe as cosmic expansion. I mean, we're all taught that the universe began with the Big Bang, this sudden explosion out of nowhere. And again, a lot of people think, you know, what did happen before the Big Bang took place? Can you tell us a little bit more about what precipitated the Big Bang?
A common misconception, I think, that people have about the Big Bang is that it was like an explosion. Right? That you had some sort of primordial seed that blew up and threw things off in every direction. And the reality is nothing like that. In fact, a better way to think of the Big Bang is that it's a boundary in time, not a point in space. And at that boundary in time, this 13.8 billion years ago, an infinitely large universe sprang into existence all at once. The Big Bang happened everywhere in an infinitely large space at the same time. This is a little hard to get your head around, I know. And the question is, what set those initial conditions? Why did this huge infinite space pop into existence at all? And this is where inflation comes in. So the idea of cosmic inflation is that before this hot, dense initial state of this infinite universe coming into existence, there was a period of expansion. So the universe was also expanding before this, but it was of a very different character. For one thing, instead of being hot and dense, it was cold and empty, and it was filled with nothing except the energy of empty space itself. And that energy of empty space drove an expansion so rapid that everything we see, our entire observable universe, which is everything we see and everything we ever will be able to see, stretched from about the size of a grapefruit to the size of the universe today in a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. So it's truly amazingly rapid expansion of this tiny initial state into the large universe that we happen to live in.
Well, you talk about something called cosmic horizons in your book. Can you give us an easy to understand overview of what this is?
Well, just like on the surface of the Earth, if you look out, you can only see a certain distance because the Earth's surface curves away from you. So you see yourself being at the center of a circular horizon. Similarly, in the cosmos, there's a horizon. That is, we see ourselves at the center of a sphere because it's a three-dimensional object. But the idea of the cosmic horizon is that because the universe has a finite age and because light travels at a finite speed, you can't see out forever because light has to have time to get to you from these distant places. So although the universe is presumably infinite, although or at least certainly much, much larger than the patch of it that we can see, our local, what we call the observable universe or a horizon, is just how far out you can see within the age of the universe. So for example, if the universe is 14 billion years old, you can only see out about 14 billion light years, the distance that light would travel in that amount of time. And anything further away from that, light hasn't had time to get from there to us in the age of the universe.
Well, you're talking about the observable universe, and I know the Hubble has observed stars that come very close to within a couple hundred million years of the Big Bang. So is it possible, perhaps with the brand new Webb telescope, that would be able to see beyond that, in that, you know, the Big Bang will be recalculated?
Absolutely. So The thing to understand about telescopes is that telescopes really are time machines. Because light travels at a finite speed, when we look out in space, we're also looking back in time. And we think of light as traveling so fast that it's almost instantaneous. We really don't worry about the speed of light in our normal everyday lives. But light actually travels at a really slow pace. So the way I like to put it is that the speed of light is about 30 centimeters per billionth of a second, or about a foot. So a billionth of a second is about how long it takes your cell phone to do one calculation in the chip. And in that amount of time, light only travels about 30 centimeters. And so that when we look out in space, we're looking back in time. When we look at the sun, we see the sun not as it is right this second, but as it was 8 minutes ago, because it takes the light 8 minutes to get to us. When we look out at the nearest large galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy, it takes light 2.5 million years to get to us from there. And so we see it as it was 2.5 million years ago. The Hubble telescope, the most distant objects that Hubble can see, were emitted, the light was given off by those objects when the universe was only about 750 million years old, between 5 and 700 million years. And so that light has been traveling to us all this time and is just now reaching us. The new telescopes, in particular the James Webb, will actually be able to see out further still and further back in time. This is really great because an archaeologist, for example, has to reconstruct the past from indirect evidence, from relics. You dig up bones and you figure out what the animals must have looked like, for example. We cosmologists have it relatively easy, is that we don't have to speculate on what the past looked like. We can actually see it. So if you build a telescope that can see out 10 billion light years, you see the universe as it was 10 billion years ago. So the entire history of the cosmos from the Big Bang to today is spread out in front of us. And the further out we look with our telescopes, the further back in time we see, and the earlier and earlier in the history of the universe that we see. So the Webb telescope, for example, will be able to see far enough back in time that it will actually see the formation of the first galaxies in the universe. It won't quite see far out enough to see the formation of the first stars in the universe, when what are called the dark ages ended and the first stars formed and lit the universe up with light. but it will see the immediate aftermath of that. And that's a very exciting prospect.
Let's take a break. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download at our new website, voaafrica.com. You can also find our show on Apple Podcasts and other podcast websites. We hope you'll connect with us on Facebook at VOA Current Affairs or Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. You can also send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Now let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today we're discussing the mysterious origins of the universe and all it contains. My guest is William Will Kinney, a professor of physics at the University of Buffalo College of Arts and Sciences in Buffalo, New York. Professor Kinney is also the author of a newly released book that explores the origins of the universe called An Infinity of Worlds, Cosmic Inflation and the Beginning of the Universe. Well, when discussing topics like cosmology, I think it's difficult not to mention the contributions made by the late, great Albert Einstein.
Einstein's theory of gravity, which is called general relativity, is really the GOAT, right? It's the greatest of all time. It has withstood tremendous efforts to falsify it, if you like, so that every time we try to measure something, every time we test Einstein's theory of gravity, it comes out exactly right. That's a really beautiful thing.
One of the things that he tried to reconcile, from what I'm remembering, is the idea of quantum physics with the general theory of relativity. Can you tell us about any role that quantum physics may have played in the creation of the universe?
Well, the unification of gravity and quantum mechanics is one of the foremost outstanding problems in theoretical physics currently. They don't play nicely with each other. They're not, as far as we know, they're not compatible. And coming up with a larger theory that incorporates both of them is something that we still have yet to do. However, getting back to the theory of inflation in particular, this theory of what happened before the Big Bang, quantum mechanics is really essential. Because one of the other things that the standard Big Bang cosmology doesn't explain is where structure in the universe came from. The universe we see today is full of galaxies and planets and stars and people and all of these things that the universe is clumpy and has all of this very complex structure in it on scales heading out toward hundreds of millions of light years. What we do know about this structure was that it was created by gravity acting on tiny little perturbations in the early universe. So the early universe was almost completely smooth. And it had little regions that were a little bit more dense than their surroundings and regions that were a little bit less dense, these little fluctuations in the density of the universe that were about one part in 100,000. And we can measure these in various ways. But what the standard cosmology doesn't tell you is where those initial seeds for structure in the universe came from. The theory of inflation answers this with quantum mechanics. In inflation, this is actually a quantum mechanical process that happens in this extraordinarily rapid expansion that happens before the onset of the hot Big Bang. Tiny little quantum fluctuations in the vacuum of space are stretched out to enormous scales. And these echoes that are left behind in the curvature of the space-time itself form the seeds of cosmic structure that forms into everything we see in our universe later. So it's a very elegant unification of gravity and quantum physics that explains the origin of everything we see in the cosmos.
And when we're talking about quantum physics, we're actually talking about subatomic particles. So we're going, instead of going big, we're going very basic parts of elements, very basic physics. In other words, right. The internal workings of matter.
That's exactly right. And one of the beautiful things about cosmology is that because the physics of what happened in the universe when it was very young is the physics of things at very high energies and very short distances, it provides a point where the physics of inner space, quantum mechanics, and the physics of fundamental particles meets the physics of outer space, cosmology, galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and so on. They actually unify and they meet in a full circle at the first moment of time. And this provides a very, very elegant picture of the origins of the cosmos itself.
I understand one of the ways that scientists could study the Big Bang is through something called a cosmic microwave background, or CMB. What is this How is it discovered and how is it captured?
The cosmic microwave background is, simply put, is the light left over from the Big Bang. So the early universe would have been very hot and very dense. And in fact, it would have been like something like a thick fog. It would be, you wouldn't be able to see very far through it because the light was scattering so much off this hot, dense gas. As the gas cooled, about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe suddenly went through a transition when it went from being opaque, like a thick fog, to being transparent. Suddenly the fog cleared. And the light that was bouncing around in that hot gas that was, you know, about half the temperature of the surface of the sun would have been freed to propagate throughout space. And that light, this glow left over from the initial hot gas, fills the entire universe. And as the universe expanded, that glow cooled, but it's still there. So what would have been visible to your eye at the time when the light was first emitted, because of the expansion of the universe since then, between when it was 400,000 years old and now at almost 14 billion, the wavelength has stretched and now it's brightest in the microwaves. This was first discovered in 1965 by Penzias and Wilson, who were two scientists who were working for Bell Labs. And they were experimenting with microwave communications for satellites in the early days of satellite communications. And they actually detected this background noise in their antenna, and they had no idea what it was. And it was David Wilkinson and Robert Dickey at Princeton, who were two cosmologists who were actually looking for this light left over from the Big Bang at the time, immediately recognized what it was, and they were seeing this light. In fact, if you take an old school television, an old analog one, and you tune it off the channel, so what you see is static, about 1% of that static is light left over from the Big Bang itself. And that is what the cosmic microwave background is. And that actually allows us, by looking at that light, we can see exactly what the universe looked like when it was only about 400,000 years old. We can directly observe it.
Going back to the early history of the universe, after the Big Bang, I understand the universe was bright and hot, and it lasted, I don't know, how long did this period of early universe last, where nothing else existed but this bright, hot space?
The universe gradually cooled. So, for example, the first elements were formed in nuclear reactions that happened between when the universe was between 1 second and 3 minutes old. All of the hydrogen and helium in the universe was formed by an age of about 3 minutes. The universe cooled and became transparent about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. This was when the cosmic microwave background was released. And after that, the universe entered a period called the Dark Ages, where there were no stars, there was no light being emitted, and gradually dark matter was collapsing into halos, pulling the hydrogen and helium gas into those halos along with it, gradually becoming denser and denser until finally, we don't know exactly how long, but somewhere around 200 million years after the Big Bang, the first stars formed and filled the universe with light. And this ended the Dark Ages and entered the age of the stars and the galaxies, which is where we live now.
Speaking of stars, when we're talking about the first stars that ever formed, at the time, you would have to admit there weren't many elements in the universe. There was what, hydrogen, helium, and perhaps another element as well. How did those particular stars happen to form when they didn't have the sophistication of the stars that we're seeing now? In other words, they didn't have the additional elements that current stars produce.
That's right. So all of the things that are heavier than hydrogen and helium in the universe, all the things that make us up, the carbon and the oxygen and the metals and all of these things that make up our bodies, for example, were all produced in stars, in nuclear reactions in the centers of stars. The first stars formed when there were none of these elements in the universe, only hydrogen and helium. So these stars would have been very, very different than modern stars. They would have been much larger, much brighter, and they would have had extremely short lifetimes, perhaps millions or tens of millions of years, no more, compared to the sun, which has a lifetime of almost 10 billion years. So these stars would have been huge, massive, and very short-lived, and they would have exploded very quickly into supernovas, and those explosions would have seeded the gas in the cosmos with the heavier elements that were necessary later to form stars like the ones we see today and also to form life.
So in other words, when a star reaches the end of its lifetime, especially if it's a supermassive star, it ends its life in a supernova, it explodes. And with that explosion, it throws out more sophisticated elements, such as iron, gold, and platinum. Have we found evidence of any newer elements that were produced by more recent supernovas?
Well, one of the interesting things is that the elements like gold and platinum, all the precious metals, for example, Those were not primarily formed in supernovae. They were formed mostly in mergers of neutron stars. So neutron stars are actually these incredibly dense remnants that are left behind after supernovae occur. And these remnants sometimes orbit in and merge with each other in a cataclysmic merger that gives off, we can see them happening because of the gravitational waves they emit. This is one of the things that the LIGO telescope sees. And it is now known that most of, for example, the gold, and if you have a gold jewelry, almost all of the gold in that jewelry was formed in the mergers of two neutron stars at some distant point in the universe, which I think is really cool.
I don't know if you've seen this or not, Will, but there was a recent study from Princeton University physicists, and they proposed that the rapid expansion of the universe could slow within 65 million years and within 100 million years stop and begin to contract over billions of years until it ends and possibly is reborn again. Your thoughts?
I'm fairly skeptical of this. We have no particular evidence that the expansion of the universe is slowing down. In fact, rather the opposite. All of the evidence indicates that the expansion is speeding up. So this is an idea. It's an interesting idea, but it's a purely hypothetical one. We have no particular actual observational evidence that this is going to occur. Maybe it will. It's impossible to tell for sure.
So do you see the universe actually coming to an end? In other words, it's not an infinite universe. It does have a beginning. It does have an ending.
As far as we know, although the universe had a beginning, and this is well established and uncontroversial, the future of the universe is less well determined. But our best guess, based on what we know the universe is made of now, in particular the dark energy that is dominating the density of the universe, if this dark energy is stable, if it doesn't decay with time or have some sort of other time dependence, the conclusion you draw is that the universe will not come to any kind of an end, but it will expand infinitely. Weirdly enough, that infinite expansion will be so fast that we will ultimately find ourselves, our galaxy, alone in a completely empty space, devoid of any other galaxies. And eventually all the stars in our galaxy, after about 100 trillion years or so, the last stars in our galaxy will go out, and the end state of the universe will be cold, dark, and empty. This is our current best guess, although it's very difficult to predict things hundreds of trillions of years in advance, as you might imagine.
I've been reading that some scientists say that the Big Bang was not only the beginning of our universe, but was the ending of a previous universe, and that there were other universes even before that. Do you buy into that theory?
If you take this theory of inflation, which has, because it creates the structure in the universe that we see today, we can actually test this theory. We can match its predictions for what the structure in the universe ought to look like against what we see. If you then calculate the consequences of this, you come to find that it predicts almost inevitably that our universe is not unique, but it is one of many, many other universes that are continuously being produced out of a larger structure in a process called eternal self-reproduction. So the picture of the universe that you get from inflation at the end of the day is nothing like this little patch of the universe we live in, but that our universe is in fact one of an innumerable number of others that are constantly popping into existence in a much larger and potentially much, much older environment. So the inflationary universe could be unimaginably old and unimaginably vast. And our, what we call our universe, our entire infinite space that we live in, would be one of many, many, many others that are constantly being produced out of empty space itself. So the picture that you get is very different.
You're suggesting a multiverse, in other words.
It's basically an almost inevitable consequence of inflation itself. Yes.
And we were introduced to the concept of multiverse in the movie Interstellar.
Sure. And it's certainly a standard trope of science fiction, you know, Marvel multiverse and all of these things. So it's something that I think fires up people's imagination a lot. The multiverse of inflation, of course, it would be, as far as we know anyway, impossible to travel to these other universes because of the presence of these cosmic horizons that we talked about earlier. We're trapped within our own little horizon. And unless, for example, Einstein's theory of gravity is wrong in some fundamental way or something similar, then these other universes that may or may not be out there would be forever inaccessible to us by any conceivable measurement, observation, or way to travel to them. So it presents a cosmologist like me with an interesting problem in that we're sort of moving beyond the boundary of what you can really legitimately call a scientific hypothesis at all. If you can't ever tell whether or not that those things are out there, is it really science to suggest that they are? That's a difficult question.
Will Kinney, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and explaining some of the theories that have taken place over the years. Thank you so much today for joining
us
today.
Rick. It's been a real pleasure.
That was William Will Kinney, a professor of physics at the University at Buffalo College of Arts and Sciences in Buffalo, New York. Professor Kinney is also the author of a newly released book that explores the origins of the universe called An Infinity of Worlds, Cosmic Inflation and the Beginning of the Universe. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Thanks for listening. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Marissa Melton. Russia claims to have captured Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine after a nearly three-month siege that left over 20,000 civilians feared dead. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Russia's defense minister Sergei Shoigu declared what he called a complete liberation of Mariupol and of the Azovstal steel plant in the port city. The plant was the last stronghold of Ukrainian resistance. There was no immediate confirmation from Ukraine. Russian state media claimed over 2,400 Ukrainian fighters who had been holed up in the steel mill had surrendered. As they surrendered, the troops were taken prisoner by the Russians, and at least some were taken to a former penal colony. Others were said to be hospitalized. I'm Karen Chamas.
On Saturday, President Zelensky told reporters that Ukraine needs to become a full candidate to join the European Union rather than signing up to the kind of broader European political community proposed by the president of France. Zelensky called such a deal a compromise. Ukraine would have to meet rigorous standards in governance and fight corruption before it could be admitted as an EU member. French President Emmanuel Macron raised hackles in Ukraine on May the 9th by suggesting that the country could take decades to become a full EU member and should aspire instead to join what he called the European political community. Russia invaded Ukraine in February in part to thwart Kyiv's tilt toward integration with the EU and NATO. Macron's European political community initiative will be debated at an EU summit in late June. Macron has suggested that Britain, which left the EU after a referendum, could also join such a grouping. You can keep up on all the discussion about the EU and Ukraine at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday. Partial results show the opposition Labour Party is set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule. Partial results showed Morrison's Liberal National Coalition had been punished by voters in Western Australia and affluent urban seats in particular. Labour has yet to reach the number of lower House seats required to form a government alone. Final results could take time as counting of a record number of postal votes is completed. A spokesman for Thailand's negotiating team has told VOA its just-ended truce with the insurgents in the country's deep south is a success. The spokesman said Thailand hopes to settle the rules of a long-term ceasefire by the end of the year. Ethnic Malay Muslim rebels in Buddhist-majority Thailand are fighting for independence for the country's three southernmost provinces. Over 7,300 people have been killed in the fighting since violence flared up last in 2004 and the government imposed martial law over the region. The top U.S. military officer is challenging the next generation of Army soldiers to prepare America's military to fight future wars that may look little like the wars of today. Army General Mark Milley is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His remarks were for graduating cadets at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. His address painted a grim picture of a world that is becoming more unstable, with great powers intent on changing the global order, and he told the cadets they will bear the responsibility to make sure that America is ready. Tesla and SpaceX Chief Executive Officer Elon Musk has met with Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro to discuss connectivity and other projects in the Amazon rainforest. The Brazilian communications minister arranged the meeting, saying he's seeking partnerships to bring or improve internet in schools and health facilities in rural areas. A new poll shows U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating dipped to the lowest point of his presidency in May, with deepening pessimism emerging among members of his own Democratic Party. Only 39% of U.S. adults approve of Biden's performance as president, this according to a poll by AP and the Center for Public Research. Overall, only about 2 in 10 adults said the United States is heading in the right direction or that the economy is good. Both of those numbers are down from about 3 in 10 a month ago. Our top story once again, Russia claims to have captured Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine after a nearly 3-month siege that has left more than 20,000 civilians feared dead. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
I think that the problems that we are facing as a country, they are not, these are not mere problems between a ruling party and an opposition political parties. These are problems of Ugandans.
Expectations are high as Ugandans await President Yoweri Museveni's nation address Sunday.
Government for the ruling party to have a negotiation, to have a dialogue with the opposition political party, specifically Chadema. So we are seeing them opening up. So let's go and see if they are really genuine or they are just doing a lip service. We can make a conclusion after meeting them.
Talks between Tanzania's ruling party and the main opposition party, Chadema, are set to begin at the end of the month.
The SME ministry, the new investments, such as the one which has come through with through SQM, are those that are going to cushion some of these early shocks that may be received while we stabilize the investment environment in Zambia.
And Zambia's Minister for Labor and Social Security says the administration is recruiting teachers and nurses before the end of the year. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Expectations are high as Ugandans await President Yoweri Museveni's nation address scheduled for Sunday. Linda Nabusai, the special presidential press secretary, says President Museveni will address the nation about the economic situation in the country. The address, officials say, will be broadcast on television and radio stations as well as on social media platforms. It comes as opposition and civil society groups call on the government to resolve what they say are the escalating prices of goods and services. For analysis and expectations of the president's speech to the nation, I reached Godbert Mushabi. He is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist.
In my view, there is nothing much that you can really expect that is new, given the conditions that we are facing. Secondly, we are a country that is deeply in debt. Our revenues are very low. Our budget is largely dependent on borrowing and foreign grants. Our tax-to-GDP ratio is just around 14% of GDP. So the government has no financial flexibility to be able to make any interventions of whatever nature to be able to ameliorate the problems that the population is facing. So I really don't have any much expectation that he would say anything new other than explaining the problems, which he does most of the time.
Well, some people are suggesting that since a lot of Ugandans have expressed concern about the sharp rise in goods and services in Uganda, it is just appropriate for the president to assure the nation about his government's plan to try to reduce the burden on the average Ugandan. They expect that the president will try to come out with some solutions to resolve their concerns. Your thoughts?
The current situation is very tough, Peter, to tell you. Right now we are in the school opening season. I know many parents who are going through a tough situation, getting kids back to school. There are many, many kids right now that are not yet back in school because they can't pay fees. So the situation is very, very tough, I can tell you. Because you see, for a country to have to expand the range of policy tools to intervene, it must have been organizing itself and planning for these kinds of eventualities. For Mr. Mseven's government, is a government that runs a huge patronage network of elected and non-elected leaders. So he doesn't have the flexibility. Even if he wanted to do it, he doesn't have the flexibility to be able to do to make the kinds of interventions that would be needed to ameliorate the current situation that citizens are faced with.
Are you therefore saying Ugandans who are expecting him to talk about healthcare delivery, service delivery, apart from the pressures, which a lot of people are saying, economies of every country is being impacted due to ongoing world events, and that it will be unfair to criticize the government for world events that have sharply affected the economy. They also talked about, they expect the president to talk about cheap substitute to hike commodities. Your thoughts?
I totally agree that some of the causes, some of the commodity prices here are really triggered by the ongoing global events, the war in Ukraine, its impact on fuel prices. We know that Malaysia just changed its policy and saying it's adding it has to add value to its palm oil production, palm oil raw materials. So that means that you would have cooking oil in Uganda or anywhere around the world, the price is going up. So in other words, I can fully understand. I am only saying that the government should be in a position to mitigate the costs of school fees, mitigate costs of healthcare, mitigate costs of, you know, there are a range of things that you can do which are within our means than the global events that affect everybody.
Recently, we've seen a former main opposition leader and presidential candidate Chisa Besigye wanting to go on demonstration and to call on the attention of the government to resolve the escalating prices of goods and services in Uganda. Some are wondering why other opposition political parties are not joining him in this, since they have also been complaining about the sharp rise in commodities. What are your views about that?
I think that the situation in Uganda is a difficult situation. So first of all, so the reason you don't see people in Uganda protesting is not because they are happy of the situation. So you have to factor in the question of fear. Secondly, I think that the problems that we are facing as a country, these are not mere problems between a ruling party and an opposition political parties. These are problems of Ugandans.
Godbertu Mushabe is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Tanzania, talks between the ruling Chama Pinduzi and the main opposition Chadema are scheduled to begin at the end of the month. Analysts say the move signals a shift in policy of President Samia Suluhu Hassan to engage the biggest opposition party. It came after the president held talks with Freeman Mbowe, national chairman of the main opposition party, shortly after he was released from jail. Chadema petitioned President Hassan for a meeting to help ease political tensions in the East African country. For the latest development and expectations of the much-anticipated dialogue between the ruling CCM and the main opposition party Chadema, I read John Rema. He is the Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema.
since when Freeman Mbowe was freed, he just went straight to the State House by the invitation of the President Samia Suluhu Hassan, and that's where we started initiating a dialogue between Chadema, the ruling party, and the government. And they have been there last week, again, for the same purpose, and they agreed that we have to form teams for dialogue. Chadema should submit a team of not less than 10 people, and the government and the ruling party will submit the team as well. So we are expecting to hold the dialogue at the end of this month between Chadema, the ruling party, and the government on the other side.
Chadema has been seeking to have a dialogue with the president for a long time. How do you feel about this acceptance to meet you, and what are some of the major issues that you seek to address?
It is true that we have been waiting since the year 2020, April, when Freeman Mbowe written a letter to the late President John Magufuli about the need to have a dialogue to discuss what transpired in the 2020 general election in the country. But Magufuli never responded until he died last year. So when Samia Suluhu Hassan, the new president, accepted that, we saw that as a new government wanting to have a dialogue with us. So it's a thing we've been waiting for so long. The major issues we are expecting to go and discuss is about, the first issue is about what transpired in the 2020 general election, why that election was so badly rigged. But the other issue is the need to have a new constitution for the country. This is a major issue. And also we have proposed that we have to sit and discuss about the need to form a truth and reconciliation committee for the country, because so many things happened for the last 6 years during the Magufuli time. We have to bring these people together. So many people have suffered in this country, from political leaders, politicians, businessmen, farmers, even to the fishermen. So everybody, we want to bring this nation together. So those are the three major issues we want to talk to the president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, and not forget about the need to have an independent electoral commission, so that in the coming elections, we want to go back to the 2020 election where everything was rigged. So those are the main issues we are going to put on the table and discuss with the government and the ruling party on the other side.
If the government decides that a new constitution, as you are demanding, is a non-starter during the dialogue, will this be a dialogue breaker? Will this be a no-go area that without talking about the demand for a new constitution, the talks cannot proceed?
We are going to bring on the table a make-or-break issue when we are going to meet in the first meeting. So for the time being, I can't say which is going to be a make-or-break issue, but we are going to bring them on the table on our first meeting, so that if they will say that they don't want that, then it is a break from the very start. So for now, we have agreed on various issues which are make-or-break. But I can't reveal it right now. We are going to reveal it when we meet at the first meeting with the president and his team from the other side of the ruling party and the government.
What are your expectations ahead of the much anticipated meeting between the ruling party and your party?
We are expecting to have a dialogue, genuine one, because even the ruling party vice chairman, Abrahamani Kinana, has said that there is a need for the government, for the ruling party to have a negotiation, to have a dialogue with the opposition political party, specifically Chadema. So we are seeing them opening up. So let's go and see if they are really genuine or they are just doing a lip service. We can make a conclusion after meeting them.
Following the announcement that you will be meeting them, what were some of the reactions from members of your party?
Some members of our party, because they have been living in this situation of them being jailed, being sent to the police all the time, some of them doesn't see the genuinity from the other side. But the leaders are trying to tell them that let's give them an olive branch. If they'll break it, it's up to them and not up to us. So it is true that some of our members are scared about it, but Let's wait and see.
John Mrema is the Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Zambia's Minister for Labour and Social Security says President Hakainde Hichilema's administration has implemented measures to recruit 30,000 teachers and 11,000 nurses before the end of the year. Brenda Tambatamba also says he has created an enabling business environment to encourage Zambians to invest as well as attract foreign investors in sectors of the economy, including mining. Her remarks follow President Hakainde Hichilema's call for a concerted effort to improve the operating environment of the mining sector. His call came during a speech at the annual African Mining in Durban recently held in Cape Town, South Africa. For more on the labor market in Zambia, I reached Brenda Tambatamba via Skype. She is Zambia's labor and social security minister.
The New Dawn government has immediately launched into the recommitment and getting back to the voters with the deliverable of jobs, and not just jobs, but meaningful jobs. And certainly, the larger population of those that are to benefit from these jobs are young people. At our first budget, the New Dawn government of His Excellency, the President, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema, did announce the first initiative, which was about sourcing funds to pick up on the backlog of recruitment for both the education and health sectors, the two critical sectors, so service delivery, education and health. And pronouncements were made to the extent that close to 44,000 jobs would be made available to ensure that there'll be an uptake from the numbers to begin to unclog the numbers of those who are coming out of college. And so that is the first most practical thing a responsible government does.
You know, the mining industry employs a lot of Zambians, from the youth to the elderly. There are fears that the mining companies have been sacking or shedding employees. How do you respond to such concerns?
I think first and foremost, before I even jump to that particular one, I think it's important to see a government that is operating methodically, delivering on its commitments methodically. But the SME ministry, the small and medium enterprise ministry, a new ministry has been formed. And that too was meant to target the employment of the youth, upskilling them in entrepreneurship, for them to begin to become future employers or self-employers who become future employers. So that too is a mechanism combined with the CDF that has been put in place, an unprecedented quantum leap from somewhere 1.6 million kwachas to 25.7 million that has been unleashed, bearing in mind that this would create jobs through the SME enterprises that are being chaperoned, coached, and mentored through that new ministry, but at the front line in the rural areas that have been ignored for many, many years. The government of the president, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema, has already put a cushion, buffer zone, ensuring that people have got an opportunity to create employment for themselves. So this is a social safety net. This is social security that is being provided to ensure that we're doing some things for ourselves before we start thinking about what the mining companies are going to provide. Any mining company that will let go people will have to come to this ministry and other relevant ministries like mines ministry, commerce, and the three different ministries. We'll work with them to find the best way to be a corporate citizen that takes care that you do not throw out people without due attention of where they are going to go. So those who may come out of there, of those redundancies, we still have a social safety net, a social security package of what I've described here.
I was about to ask you about the president's speech at the Indaba, at the conference. Not specifically with what the president spoke about. How does that practically influence the job creation in Zambia?
FQM, you have heard amongst the announcements that have been made in South Africa. We have a corporate citizen that is on the Zambian mining industry scenario. They are running two mines, large scale. Two of the five large scale mines in Zambia are run by FQM. FQM has just announced a $1.3 billion to begin to reinvest, to expand, because of the good climate environment for investment that has been created by the New Dawn government. And that too is another port that will be able to assist us to take on, to absorb some of those who may be coming from some of those redundancies. So we, as a government, are well coordinated to track, monitor, and ensure that we manage those dynamics that are taking place, where there's some that are out of one window. We have windows that are open, tunnels that are open to absorb the other ones. So the CDF, the SME ministry, the new investments, such as the one which has come through with through FQM, are those that are going to cushion some of these early shocks that may be received while we stabilize the investment environment in Zambia.
Brenda Tambatamba is Zambia's Labour and Social Security Minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. European Union election observers say Zimbabwe risks having another disputed election next year unless it ensures the country's election body is independent of the government and ruling party. For VOA Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital Harare, free, fair elections are a condition that Western countries have set for lifting sanctions imposed for alleged election rigging 20 years ago.
Elmer Brook, the head of the EU Electoral Mission, told reporters Friday that as Zimbabwe prepares for next year's elections, it must amend its electoral laws so that all parties have a fair chance of winning at the polls. Brook and his team were assigned to Zimbabwe by Brussels to share their findings after their first visit to Zimbabwe during the July 2018 elections. In an interview with VOA, Brook, a German national, said the mission gave Zimbabwean officials 23 recommendations for genuine electoral reforms.
It has to do with an equal playing field, impartiality and of media, equal treatment of the parties, the proper voters' registration. So there's multi-party liaison committee, commission. There will be a proper conduct of elections. The conduct on election day, the transparency, and then counting and the collection of the counts to the final results. If that is transparent and clear and no loopholes, then is that the best way to have peace in a country? Because nobody can say there was something which was wrong with the elections. To get credibility of election.
Zimbabwe officials would not comment Friday on Brooks' statement. Earlier, though, Rafael Faranisi, the acting permanent secretary in Zimbabwe's Foreign Affairs Ministry, said the government is looking forward to June 7 when Harare and Brussels officials meet.
This will be yet another opportunity to candidly assess progress to date and plan for the future based on realistic expectations. I've heard the concerns expressed with respect to developments in Zimbabwe, but I just wish to put it at record that in terms of the reforms that we've carried out, the challenge is, I just want you to give me 3, 4, 5 countries on our continent that have really done better than us. For those who have been following closely developments in Zimbabwe, we are on that reform trajectory and it's not reversible.
For years, Zimbabwe's elections have been marred by violence, voter intimidation, and allegations of rigging, leading to disputed results. When President Emmerson Mnangagwa succeeded Robert Mugabe in 2017, Mnangagwa promised to improve how elections are held, but the opposition continues to accuse the ruling ZANU-PF party and the government of manipulating the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa.